I'm not your typical engineer.
This is Paul Burnett interviewing Diron Apelian, and it's March 17th, 2015, and we're here at Orlando, Florida for the TMS conference, and this is audio file one, and this is for the Global Mining and Materials Research Project. So let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us where you were born and where you grew up?
Before we get going, Paul, I need to ascertain something.
Sure.
I look over there or I look at you?
Oh, you should definitely look at me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have no clue. Sometimes you see these newscasters who are looking at the wrong place while the camera is somewhere else. Okay. I was born in 1945, October, mm-hmm. October 28, 1945, in Cairo, Egypt. Mm-hmm. My dad was working with the British Army at the time, not as a soldier, but selling them typewriters and things of that sort. Mm-hmm. And my mother's family, who's from Milan, Italy, Mussolini was in Libya, and they had some holdings in North Africa. So my parents met there, and I was born in Cairo. Grew up there till I was about nine and a half, ten. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful time. It was a different era, obviously. There was a king at the time, King Farouk, and he was deposed. My dad's company was nationalized.
Right.
So we migrated to Lebanon, mm-hmm. to Beirut, mm-hmm. which was a French influence from World War II, still a French colony to some extent. And we lived there for about 4 or 5 years, and then problems began there as well, where Eisenhower sent the troops in. I remember distinctly one day, I was about 14, my dad came home and said, "We're leaving Middle East. Mm. We're going to go to America." Mm. And he found, at that time, you couldn't go to America. You had to have a sponsor.
Right.
And he found William Sroy's brother, I don't know how he met him, to be our sponsor. So we're actually heading to San Francisco, to Fresno. But we stopped in Philadelphia, and then he met a third or fourth cousin of ours, and we ended up in Philadelphia. So at the age of 15, I came to America, having lived in Egypt for 9-10 years, and then 4 or 5 years in Lebanon at a private school.
Mm-hmm. How was that adjustment coming to the U.S.?
Well, that's interesting. I had a lot of much of who I am today, and like anybody else, is a product of our experiences.
Right.
So I had to learn how to adapt. I had to learn how to be agile, not to whine, just figure out that survival.
Yeah.
Survival skills.
Right.
So leaving Egypt, going to Lebanon, first year I had to be in a boarding school in a completely new area. So you become independent, you figure out things, you learn how to deal with situations, mm-hmm. language. So, because my first 15 years, it was mostly Italian, Armenian, French, mm-hmm. a little bit of Arabic. Mm-hmm. And after 15, coming to America at the age of, 10th grade, all of a sudden, in a high school in Haverford, Pennsylvania, everything's in English. I can't figure out what the words mean. It was a transformation.
I mean, some of the students must have been interested in where you'd been, right?
Well, that was the lucky or fortunate part, which is the essence of America to some extent, and the reason why I love this land of ours so much. And you'll find that most immigrants are more fervent Americans than people who are born here, because you take it for granted. It's natural, mm-hmm. natural, human, to do so, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But what I found coming to America at the age of 15 was classmates who were just so intrigued, wanted to learn. I was welcomed. I was worried about having a different name. Didn't matter. Mm-hmm. That pluralistic, democratic DNA of the nation, my second year I was selected to be the vice counsel for student body, mm-hmm. it was pretty cool. I got I got adapted and inculcated into the culture very quickly, mm-hmm. very quickly. I think much of it was because of the welcoming, the hospitality, the sincere, genuine happiness of people having somebody from with
somewhere
my background.
Else. Right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you went to high school in Haverford?
I went to high school in Haverford for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I went to. We really didn't have the means, actually, because of we couldn't take things out of the Middle East. My dad was not able to bring much of his. When things get nationalized by the government, you can't take things out.
Right.
So I had applied to Yale, Carnegie. At the time, it was called Carnegie Institute of Technology, mm-hmm. and Drexel. I went to Drexel because of the cooperative experience. Mm-hmm. You know how that works. You know, you go to school first year and fifth year, and then between 6 months in and out. So you're making some money to pay for the college. And so I didn't want to be a burden to my parents, so I paid essentially my way through college. Mm. I saved every penny and from the work study and was able to fund my college education that way.
And in a lot of universities, that work study is not just perhaps it was for the disadvantaged, but it's now seen as a positive boon. Do you think that helped you in the sense that you got real work experience?
Yeah. I know we're going to come back to this later, but today I'm at WPI. Mm-hmm. I've been there almost 25 years at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And the school was founded during the Industrial Revolution by two industrialists who believed in theory and practice. Mm-hmm. And there was no income tax at that time, as you well know. So it was mostly philanthropic, but it was more self-serving. They needed people for their factories and their workshops. So the application side of engineering was the hallmark of the school. So what I am at WPI today is all based on the German, the motto of the university is Lehren Kunst, which means theory and practice. So to your question, absolutely yes. Even though at the time my motive was to make money so I can pay my way, but ultimately the real advantage of that was the realization of the beauty of how the things I was learning in the classroom were being applied and connecting the dots. You know, there's a wonderful saying by a great English, T.S. Eliot, mm-hmm. a great English poet, Renaissance man, whatever, mm-hmm. T.S. Eliot, where he said, hell is a place where nothing connects with anything.
Yeah.
You know? So my experience working as co-op student at Drexel, you know, every 6 months at Franklin Institute Research Labs, at U.S. Steel, at a wire company in Ron's, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. those were just great experiences, formative.
Mm-hmm.
Formative. Mm-hmm. So I graduated from Drexel in 1968, 5 years at Drexel Institute of Technology, mm-hmm. which is now Drexel University.
Yep.
And then I went to MIT after that for a good 4 years or so,
mm-hmm.
and did my doctorate under a pioneer and a wonderful man, still a great friend and mentor. Mm-hmm. He's in his 80s, mid-80s or late 80s now, Merton Flemings. Who to this day is a great mentor and friend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I did that for about 4 years and graduated from MIT in 1972 or so.
Mm-hmm. Can we pause a minute on that period in the 1960s, early 70s? What were the leading research questions in your field, or the fields that you were exploring as a student, and later as someone who was doing his doctoral research?
Well, let's break it up into three areas. One is high school.
Okay.
Last year in high school, and and at Drexel, which is 5 years between 63 and 68, that era, and then at MIT between 68 and 72. So I'm going to break it up into that. The reason I ended up at Drexel and into metallurgy was actually a math teacher at Harvard who I had a good relationship with, and he was somebody I looked up to, and I was pretty good in math, and still am probably. And the Sputnik occurred that year while I was a senior. So the idea of sending a man to the moon, this is Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's period, was, you know, as a young man, incredibly inviting, and you know, it was pretty interesting. So when I was asking Mr. Kent, his name was Mr. Kent, who's deceased now, what field of engineering should I go into? He says, absolutely, no question, go into metallurgy. So without knowing much about it, I, you know, in the applications, I just put down metallurgy. And I remember I had a date for the prom, and I, you know how it works, you go and you pick up your date, and the parents want to meet you, and and the father asked me, what are you going to be doing next year, son, or something of that sort. I said, I'm going to go to college and study engineering. He said, what kind of engineering? And I said, metallurgical engineering. He said, there's a great career being a weatherman. That's good for you. So I realized there and thereafter that I have to be very, very specific when I say metallurgy. So that was the first revelation I had, that maybe the field that I'm getting into is not that well understood. But that's a true story.
Right.
So, you know, Sputnik age was one certainly milestone in my lifetime, which influenced me into going into materials and metals. At Drexel, as a, you know, as an undergraduate, of course, you're very, not naive, but, you know, you're moldable, and you can get influenced very quickly. I had some incredible teachers. Some of them are still alive, thankfully. George Dieter was our department head, who is a big name in the field. He was one of the pioneers in mechanical metallurgy. He was a department head. He took me under his wings to some extent and watched over me, making sure I was on the right track. Dick Heckel was another famous professor who's deceased now, unfortunately. So we had some very important influences in my life. So the things that metaphorically with the Sputnik age before going to Drexel was advanced powder metallurgy. That was a field that was blossoming at the time in terms of making things not from a liquid metal where you pour into a cavity and make the thing, but rather making it into small powders and compacting it and make it into shape. One of the exciting things as an undergraduate at Drexel was having the fellows from Pratt Whitney, United Technology Corporation, Bud Shank coming in to talk about single crystals, how to make turbine blades completely out of a single crystal. And I still remember that was fascinating. And I said to myself, I think, subconsciously, that's an area I want to work in. And as it turns out, I ended up going to MIT, working for one of the pioneers in silicification processing that enabled making these turbine blades and single crystal components that enables us to fly today in jets. So, so you know, Sputnik in high school era at Drexel would be powder metallurgy, a lot of advances there, and advances in manufacturing from liquid metals, you know, the casting composites. I remember we studied crafts work from Lehigh. So these are all coming back to me in my, you know, as you asked the question, but those are probably the important things that were occurring then.
And these are essentially brand new, well, in powder metallurgy.
Well, at the time it was a it was pretty revolutionary.
So, and when you manufacture from a single crystal, this gives you incredible strength and it's strong and lightweight?
Right. The way to think about it in a very simple way is that materials are crystals mm-hmm. by nature. And when you have a component that's manufactured, it has many crystals. Mm-hmm. And each crystal is identified or characterized from another crystal by the boundary that exists between the two crystals. Mm-hmm. And we call that a grain boundary. It's just a boundary. Right. It's a fence between right. the two crystals. Mm-hmm. So whenever you use a material at higher temperatures, the first place where failure may begin or a crack may initiate or degradation will occur will be at these boundaries because they're the weakest points.
Right.
That's where the atoms are not bonded as well. Mm-hmm. It's a place where you have a lot of imperfections.
Right.
So the one way to strengthen the material is to get rid of all these boundaries. And to do that is just have a single crystal. Mm-hmm. So maybe you haven't seen these blades, but these blades are about this big. Mm-hmm. The whole thing to be one crystal mm-hmm. is a feat.
Right.
It's a technological feat to right. be able to have a dendrite grow in one direction and that be the one crystal. Mm-hmm. So it is a curiosity that gets you into the door, and once you find out how it's done and you realize the complexities of fluid flow, mass flow, heat flow, and the beauty of being able to manipulate that and to make things that couldn't be done before is pretty intoxicating.
It sounds like you were hooked pretty early on.
Yeah, I was, actually. Yeah. I was.
And also going to MIT, which is one of the best places for this kind of work, to work with this great advisor that you had, Merton Flemings. And so perhaps you could talk about then your transition to from being a student to being a professor and how that came about.
It really didn't come about. I was the last thing I thought I would be is an academic.
Yeah.
As you can tell from the discussion so far, applications were always of interest to me. Mm-hmm. The Sputnik, the turbine blades, aerospace. So as much as I love the theory, I didn't really see myself doing theory for a career path in academia. Mm-hmm. So applications always interested me, perhaps more than the theory part, though I appreciate it as much, the fundamentals. So while I was at MIT, it was a period of 4 years of tremendous professional growth, also maturity as a young man. Had great, still to this day, I have these wonderful friends from those days at MIT. And all of them were going into career paths in industry. Mm-hmm. None of my peers really were thinking of going to academia.
Right.
As I said, those are formative years, so you get influenced by your buddies and close mm-hmm. friends. Mm-hmm. So I was recruited by Bethlehem Steel, which was at that time, a very important company.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore. So I was recruited in 1968 by Bethlehem Steel to go and be a project engineer, a senior engineer. And I was fortunate to work on a just the right project, a hot project, mm-hmm. if I can use that term. And it was high-strength, low-alloy steels. Mm-hmm. These were steels that were higher strength, so you could use thinner gauges of it mm-hmm. and lighten the car's weight or whatever is the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So I worked on that for a good 5 years and had a great run at it. It was a wonderful experience, really applying all the things I've learned over the years
yeah.
in college. But I wasn't married at the time, and I had a girlfriend in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So Bethlehem is about 40 miles north of
right.
Philadelphia. And, I was going down there a couple times a week. And, of course, the drive is not, it's a drive. It's not next door.
Yeah.
And then one day I got a call from my old department head at Drexel. Mm-hmm. Now, this is, remember, a vignette of maybe 5-6 years later.
Yeah.
told me that Professor Smirnov is going on a sabbatical and they need someone to teach thermodynamics. Would I be interested? Mm-hmm. So I'm doing a confession here. The reason that I actually went to my boss at Bethlehem, I said, could I do this thing? Was not because I really wanted to teach the course. I wanted to be in Philadelphia. So I took a leave of absence for 3 months, which was they were able to do, and I'm glad they did. And I stayed at Drexel and taught two courses, and my parents were living in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, so I got to see them a bit, and it was a good time. And I was ready to go back to Bethlehem, and then the dean called me in and said, Dean Woodring, Richard Woodring, and he said, you know, this hasn't happened previously, but you won the award that as the best teacher selected by the students, and usually that doesn't go to a part-time adjunct faculty. Maybe you want to think about a career at Drexel here. In those days, you could do that. You know, the search processes were not, you know, you don't have to advertise and whole process. So he essentially made me an offer. And then Alan Lowley and Harry Rogers weighed in, and before I know it, I got a job offer, you know, half my pay, and from Bethlehem Steel, and I took it. So, well, so I got sucked into it in a very circuitous way.
But the work at the Horner Research Lab was not uninteresting. It was...
I'd love the job.
I
didn't leave Bethlehem because I wasn't interested, but I so... When I was there for that three-month period, which was a blessing, you know, sometimes things happen. I went there for the wrong reasons or reasons that were not virtuous, let's say. You know, it was a girlfriend in Philadelphia. I'm gonna be, it was romance that that took me down there, you know. I never ended up marrying that girl. I just, you know, and then broke up afterwards thereafter. But anyway, the nucleation event was romance. But when I was there for 3 months, the opportunities that I saw where I could, and it had nothing to do with metallurgy. Had to do with a soul. That I could actually carve out in my life the things I want to work on, the things that interest me. Perhaps selfish, you know. But I wanted to work on the things that I'm interested in working in, and I could be my own boss. I would work harder, but I could at least have a destiny where I could manage and control myself, and I would not be influenced, controlled by corporate America, whatever, you know. So I saw an opportunity where I could have a life of enjoyment. So it was more quality of life issues, you know. I probably couldn't articulate it then at that time, but I can now. So maybe I was, you know, wise enough to figure that out at a young age. And when the dean made, or when the offer came to go to academics at Drexel, even though the compensation was less and all the fringe benefits were less, it was really the quality of life that I was hoping to have someday attracted me to that position.
So even though there was more freedom and independence in this new life, you were also later, at the time at Drexel, writing about the need for universities to have better integration or concern for industrial questions. And so did you find when you were at Drexel that there was a lack? Was it kind of more ivory tower?
No, Drexel actually was a great fit. It was a wonderful fit for me, and probably still is, I mean, to that extent. Remember, I went there as an undergraduate. I had the co-op experience. And then at Drexel, I saw even more opportunities from a pedagogical academic point of view, how we can enhance the theory and practice and how we can enhance the learning. So I became more of a facilitator of the learning environment. But I also had the urge to tell colleagues and the world about what we were doing at Drexel was so right, and what are the you can't tell people what they're doing is wrong, but you know, you can only go by being a role model. So what we were doing, so I did write about things of that sort in terms of integration of theory and practice and enhanced learning. We got involved in a self-study project, actually with a colleague from WPI, Roy Bourgeau, mm-hmm. when I was an assistant professor at Drexel, about self-study where students would learn, even though while they're on co-op and they're away in industry, they could take a course self-learning mm-hmm. with modules. So we had, for example, Introduction to Material Science in 10 modules. So very much before internet, before web, before MOOCs, all of this, mm-hmm. the learning by yourself in a guided way.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, in the old days of great, you know, Oxford, Cambridge, mm-hmm. you know, students learned on their own.
Yeah.
But you had a tutor.
Right.
That you went to see, you know, in Christ College. You went to see your tutor once a week, and he or she essentially validated, confirmed, guided you, put you back on the right track.
Right.
It was really that model, mm-hmm. which we see today, you know, on online learning to a large extent. So we were pioneers in that back at Drexel in 1978, 79 mm-hmm. era, a long time ago.
But integrated into work study so that they would be learning practical things. And presumably, students might have questions if the tutorial material was at all related to what they were experiencing in the field, then they would have questions they could bring back.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an enhanced tutorial that's coming both from theoretical learning and but it brings the university right out into the work program.
You captured it better than I could have said. In fact, I recall the word will not mean anything to you, but it doesn't matter. Electroslag refining. It's a process for making specialty alloys, super alloys, very clean. And I was teaching a course on process metallurgy, talking about electroslag remelting. You know, I've got pictures and talking about the process, what happens. And I had one student who just raised his hand and says, "Professor Pellion, I did that last summer at Carpenter." I think it was Carpenter. I said, "Really?" Yeah. So come on out here and tell us about it. Mm-hmm. And this is a junior in college. And he came to the front of the class and talked about it with great proficiency.
Great.
And, you know, I still recall that moment that saying to myself, this theory and practice thing really works.
Right.
You know.
Right. So
imagine for a second cooking.
Yeah.
If you're just listening to if you're just reading cookbooks versus seeing a great chef, you know, on YouTube or whatever. It's a big difference.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Even if you spec out exactly, you know, the instructions, there's going to be stuff that is missed. Absolutely. So during this time, you mentioned that you were now free to explore the kinds of things that you were interested in.
Well, don't take it to the nth degree here. There's no such thing as absolute freedom.
Freer,
yeah. I had the opportunity to carve out and shape things. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think there's anything like absolute freedom. Really don't.
No.
I think it's bounded.
Right.
And when it's bounded freedom, it's even more precious.
Right.
But I had the opportunity to do things that I wanted to do. And I started a career at Drexel in 1968 as a young assistant professor. Got married that year, 1976, and it was a good period.
So you got your degree in metallurgical engineering in 68 from Drexel. Then MIT, you got your doctorate.
Yeah, 71, 72. Got my
72.
SCD.
And then you were assistant prof starting in 1976.
Yes, I think 76. Yep.
Yeah. And so during the 1980s, there are a lot of changes in industry that are coming online that we could talk about. What were some of the processes that you were interested in exploring research-wise during the time that you were at Drexel?
I'm going to answer your question, but I want to do a preface first because it's going to come back again in later on, I'm sure, as we talk about the transformations in material science and metallurgy over the last 30 years or 40 years. As an academic, when you want to do research, you got to get funding.
Yeah.
You know, vision without resources is hallucination, right? So you got to get the funding. So there is this tension of doing the things you want to do and who's going to fund it.
Right.
It's almost like it also applies to architects or artists, you know. So it's not just engineers or academicians. Mm-hmm. So if the funding is available by the government, the federal government, you know, nanotechnology, and there's lots of money in this, or biomaterials, you could get swayed into that because there's funding available and you write proposals. Versus, this is what I really would like to do, and let me write proposals. So you have to have a balance between those two, and sometimes it's not one. Actually, most of the time, it's not one versus the other. Mm-hmm. You're sort of in the middle line. Mm-hmm. So that's going to come back and forth, I think, all the time. So I thought I want to make that preface first.
Sure.
So
absolutely.
I was aware of that early on, and made sure that I was not taking any funds to do things that I had absolutely no interest in. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I tried to influence the agencies to see the opportunities so they would fund the things that I want to do. Mm-hmm. So you gotta play that role.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in the to answer your question, in the late 70s, remember I joined Drexel in 76, and I left Drexel in 1990.
Yeah.
There were probably three areas that, or maybe four, that I got involved in as pathways for research, pathways for making innovations, pathways for having grad students work in these fields, and making an impact.
Right.
It's all about impact, actually.
Yeah.
It's all about impact. You want to make a difference.
Yeah.
So one area was molten metal processing. Remember now, when you're making a casting or silification, you got to start with liquid metal. Mm-hmm. How you treat the liquid metal and all the things that you do to make sure that the metal is clean, doesn't have any dirt in it, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. So that's one area, molten metal processing. Second area would be casting processes. How do you take the liquid metal, put in the cavity to make the component, how to manufacture things. Those are two.
Yeah.
Then I told you earlier that Drexel had a major initiative in powder metallurgy. Mm-hmm. And powders are not something you find at Home Depot. You know, you have to make it.
Yeah.
And it starts with liquid metal that you atomize. So every powder is a small casting. Mm-hmm. So I looked at meta beliefs of how you view the world. I looked at a powder, not as powder metallurgy, but as a small casting. Mm-hmm. So I did. The third area would be droplet consolidation, how to take powders and consolidate them together. And that led to a whole bunch of initiatives. You know, the Vader process we developed, the vacuum arc double electrode remelting with specialty metals, special metals up in Utica, New York. We developed Osprey process with Osprey spray casting, plasma deposition, so droplet consolidation would be the third area.
Okay.
So molten metal, new processes for casting, droplet consolidation, which includes a whole bunch of technologies. And came out of that is intelligent processing. Mm-hmm. How do you control these processes?
And so this is because kinetics becomes more important in metallurgy, that the actual movement and pressure can affect how crystals are formed.
Absolutely.
In the metal.
Absolutely.
And that's a really key area. And this is what Dr. Masalski was talking about yesterday, that there's this metallurgy used to be understood in terms of, mostly in terms of thermodynamics, And what they started to realize is that the rate at which you cool something under certain kinds of pressure gives you different kinds of crystals. And so this is an extension of that. That's my primitive
understanding. Absolutely. Everything you've said is absolutely correct. There's thermodynamics, which is the science of how the energy is distributed and what is allowed or not allowed, depending on the energy state. Right. Thermodynamics is a beautiful science that tells us what can be or cannot be. Is it possible to even have this phase?
Right.
You know, thermodynamically, energetically.
Right.
Depending on its chemical potential, free energy. However, the kinetics, meaning how fast you do it or how slow you do it, and at what point in time do you do it, the kinetics of it can change things. So it's a balance between thermodynamics and kinetics. But at the same time, how you impose or execute those kinetics comes about by processing methodologies. Let's take droplet consolidation. When you atomize a liquid metal into small droplets, 40 micron, 30 micron in size, that droplet has seen cooling grades that are not similar at all to a sand casting, which is this big. So that little droplet cooled much, much faster, has a much more refined microstructure. The spacing between the indices of the microstructure, we call that the dendrite arm, which we have defined as an index. The dendrite arm spacing, that tells you how refined the structure is. In a powder, it's really, really fine, versus in a sand casting where it's much coarser, where the spacings are much larger. So imagine if you have heterogeneities within the structure, segregation.
Right.
If the distance between the segregates are small, like in the powder, they're going to diffuse with each other much closer. Imagine if we're at such a distance versus we're further apart.
Right.
The diffusion distances are small.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the diffusion distance that dictates how fast things are going to happen. If they're farther apart from each other, it's going to take longer. If they're closer to each other, it's going to take shorter time. But how do you control, manipulate the diffusion distance? It's really through processing.
Mm-hmm.
So the droplet consolidation technologies, whether it's vacuum arc, double electrode, remelting, excuse me for a second.
Sure.
Let me get some water.
Sure.
Or plasma spraying, droplet consolidation, all these technologies make a big difference in terms of the control, the kinetics.
Yeah. And as you were saying that you wanted to get these things more these research programs were with an eye to applications, how they could affect industry. And there are new casting techniques coming online in industry. Are these for special materials only, like in biomedical applications, or are these do these have implications for mass production?
two questions in your question. I'll segment them. All of the processes that I've been involved in. When I say I really should talk about the team.
Sure.
You know, it's colleagues, grad students, so I have to be, I want to say that up front.
Yeah.
So whatever we developed at Drexel or at WPI, in my institute now at MPI, it's a team effort. But all of the things we've done are applicable to a variety of alloys. So even though we work for aluminum systems, it's applicable to magnesium, titanium, you know, it's mechanistically driven. The mechanisms, the principles that you can apply to different alloys.
Right.
And all of it for us, and for me, has been driven by applications.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to work on something that is not going to be applicable, applied, and cannot have an impact.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's been a universal driver.
Right, right.
And probably all of my work.
And these presumably make things cheaper. And that, I mean, they have different aspects to them. They make things, they have, the metal can have different properties. So in the aluminum alloys, you developed improvements in the aluminum, or you developed?
Yeah, the way I would characterize is that you make things that you could not make any other way previously.
Right.
So it's a way of making something that you couldn't do previously. Mm-hmm. So you're not reinventing the wheel.
Right.
And so if you have that capability, let's say, and I'm going to go all the way to the other side. Mm-hmm. Let's say a knee implant.
Mm-hmm.
Today, if you need a knee implant, it's made in a certain way, mm-hmm. but it's not made specifically for the size of your knee.
Right.
You know, there's a small, medium, large, extra large, and they put it in whatever makes the most sense.
Right.
But let's say if we could take an MRI, magnetic resonance image of your knee, and make one exactly the size of your knee, that's not necessarily cheaper. But believe me, if you don't have to do a lot of PT and it's going to be exactly your size, you'd be willing to pay a little bit more.
Yeah.
So the way to think about this is you develop processes so that you're able to make things that you couldn't make otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to commodity products, their cost is really a driver.
Yeah.
You want to develop things that are going to reduce the cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
One interview I did last year was with Dick Teets, and he talked about the development of thin slab casting. That was, in a sense, revolutionary, in that it made steel production just incredible, lot cheaper and a lot more efficient.
Yeah.
And so there are these old industries that you were at Bethlehem. And,
absolutely.
Bethlehem is no more, and in part that's because of the rise of these new processes that are just far more cost effective.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's.
Well, actually, when I was at Bethlehem, you know, open hearth and basic oxygen furnace was the way steel was made.
Right.
But now we're recycling steel. There's quite a bit of supply of steel mm-hmm. that we just remelt and reuse.
Right.
Actually, we're doing that with aluminum now. But to your point also, though, another example would be, remember I said there were four or five bins or categories of my work?
That's
one
right.
is a molten metal processing.
Mm-hmm.
Aluminum foil,
mm-hmm.
that's an application,
right?
Imagine the world without aluminum foil. Huh? Think about it for a second. Where all the burritos would not be wrapped up in aluminum foil.
That's right.
But to make aluminum foil, you've got to roll the aluminum really thin.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Really thin. The gauge is incredibly thin.
Yeah.
So if you have inclusions, which is really particles that comes into the molten metal, if you ever done any pastry work in the kitchen, you know, when you're rolling dough, you know, you get holes.
Right.
If you have impurities. Or defects or inhomogeneities or inclusions. So to be able to roll aluminum foil to the gauges that we do,
mm-hmm.
that liquid metal before it freezes cannot afford to have too many inclusions.
Right.
Or beverage cans,
right.
for that matter.
Right.
And we developed technologies actually out of my PhD, filtration.
Mm-hmm.
How to remove solid inclusions, how to remove liquid inclusions. These are liquid phases. Out of the molten metal before you cast.
Right.
Major impact.
Mm-hmm.
Major impact.
Yeah. We've all noticed that the aluminum cans have gotten lighter and lighter over the years.
That's because of molten metal processing.
Right.
You know, getting the gas out of aluminum. Aluminum loves hydrogen.
Yeah.
So in this molten state, there's a lot of hydrogen that goes in solution.
Mm.
When it freezes, however, has very limited solubility for hydrogen. So the hydrogen has to come out.
Mm.
As a solid, the hydrogen cannot be in the solid state. And comes out and forms gas bubbles.
Mm.
So, you know, you get holes, which is not what you want.
Right, right.
I'm probably boring you with all this.
No, not at all. Not
stuff.
At all. We have talked a bit about spray casting and molten processing. Plasma processing, that was something that
This is under the droplet consolidation umbrella.
Okay, that's part of that.
Under droplet consolidation. Remember now, let's go back and make sure we have the context here right.
Sure.
To make a component, you've got to, whatever it is, you got to make it. Mm-hmm. So one way is start with liquid metal. You take the liquid metal and put it into a cavity, the mm-hmm. mold, and you make that part.
Yeah.
Chinese have done it in the Zhou Dynasty, if you look at their, you know, bronze vessels, etc. Mm-hmm. So you have a mold in which you pour the liquid metal. The other way is to make a small droplet mm-hmm. that freezes, that's the powder, mm-hmm. consolidate that into the shape that you want to make,
right.
and that's being held physically by, compaction forces. And then you treat that thermally, you give it heat for diffusion to occur so that the component has integrity.
Right.
That's powder metallurgy.
Okay.
The droplet consolidation technologies, spray casting, Osprey, plasma deposition, all of these, is taking the powder and consolidate it in situ in the chamber itself.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make the powder and then collect the powder and then take the powder, put it all together, but do it as it's being atomized and it's coming down. So plasma deposition is applied today to turbines, blades, mm-hmm. where every turbine blade is coated.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially coating, mm-hmm. It's like spraying.
Right.
But the spray is not a droplet. It's a droplet at the beginning, but then it becomes solidified or partially solidified and gets deposited.
So you're essentially, in coating, you're normally coating something, but you're saying that you're actually kind of coating a mold, effectively.
Yeah.
And then that
the substrate becomes a mold.
Right.
So you could have a platform or a substrate that's rotating.
Mm-hmm.
So you could make a roll.
Mm-hmm. And shape casting, is that a separate family of innovations or research?
Well, not really, but the near net shape means that you're not making the shape and then processing it later, machining
right.
and all that. You're trying to get to the final shape as close as you possibly can in one step.
Right. Oh, this is what Dick Teets was talking about with the dog bone I-beams that they were making. They used to have to roll those in a number of processes, but if you could cast it in a way that's close to what becomes the I-beam,
yeah.
you need to roll fewer times
right.
to get that.
Yeah, or in a very simplistic way,
mm-hmm.
look at systematically, from a systems engineering point of view, look at what are the things you have to do to go from liquid metal to the final product.
Right.
What are the various steps? Can I alleviate some of these?
Right.
Do I really need all of these steps?
Right.
Can I go directly from here to here?
Right.
If you can, then it's a much better way of doing it.
Right.
So, and then you figure out what are the various ways of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And
So you spent from 1976 to all through the 80s at Drexel, and then you make a transition. Can you talk a little bit about the next mm-hmm. phase in your career?
Well, from a not scientific or technical point of view, I did my graduate work at MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And after we got married, family, two daughters, between 76 and 1989, that period of 15 years, wonderful, wonderful period. A lot of growth, professionally, advancements. I was a professor, mm-hmm. became department head, then I became vice provost of the university, the whole university at Drexel. So mm-hmm. it's a great period. A lot of professional development and growth
mm-hmm.
and learning.
Yeah.
And with a bunch of great colleagues, Alan Lowley, Roger Doherty, Michelle Barsoom, Mike Kozak, who's deceased now. So it was just a great period,
mm-hmm.
and many others.
Mm-hmm.
Raj Matharsan. But all of our vacations were done in Massachusetts or New England. So, we'd go to Monhegan Island, we go to Nantucket, you know, all our vacations, hiking in the White Mountains. So I wasn't looking for a position, but I got a call from a recruiter about a school called WPI, which I didn't know much about, mm-hmm. except that I had done this self-study learning modules with this professor, Ray Bourgeau, years ago. So we looked into it. And I think it was just a time where we needed to change.
Yeah. You know?
We just needed a change. And Drexel was going through a lot of changes, too. Mm-hmm. As vice provost, I think I had served under 4 different presidents in a 5-year period. So it was a turbulent time at Drexel at the time.
Right, right. And you were learning more about university administration.
I was. And I'm gonna clear my throat again
Sure.
here. I don't know what's going on. Trying it one more time. How is this? Is this good?
This is
audio wise. Okay.
Yep. And this is audiophile 2. So we were discussing the shift from Drexel to WPI, and it was a time for a change. Did you become a professor there? Did you change
at WPI?
Over?
I was at Drexel, active in my research, mm-hmm. but I was vice provost of the university, mm-hmm. and it was a period where I was getting quite interested in the administration of the university, how mm-hmm. it should be run.
Right.
I think you probably have seen a thread now from everything I've said so far. That I always had the interest in the business side of things,
yeah.
the applications.
Yeah.
How are things run? How are things made in addition to how are things run? So, and before vice provost, I was department head. That was also a wonderful period where we recruited a lot of people. I think I mentioned Roger Doherty and Michelle Barsoom, Frank mm-hmm. Coe. It was a growth area, a growth time. So I learned a lot about administration, organizing universities, and the finances, and so mm-hmm. it was natural. It was a natural progression. Mm-hmm. It was not something I sat down one day and said, I want to do this, you know.
Right.
It was just a natural evolution. Mm-hmm. And when the recruiter called for the position of provost, which is the chief academic officer, mm-hmm. It was attractive, enticing. So we thought about it. Is it a big move, you know, changing from Pennsylvania to Massachusetts? But Massachusetts has always been an attractive state for us. You know, I always loved New England. Maybe it was graduate school day influence, but mm-hmm. I like my wife and I and my family liked the culture of New England. Mm-hmm. So I moved to WPI as provost. But of course, with tenure as a professor
right.
in mechanical engineering. and in fact, realized after 7 years as provost that I wasn't having much interface with students, yeah. nor I was having much interface with people who are doing a lot of good work. But I spent most of my time with people who were having issues. So
that can be a little demoralizing over time.
Well, it was an interesting period of our lives that I don't want to relive again, but it was an interesting and learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I'm thankful for that.
And was your term 7 years, or was it a 5-year term? And it was
no, it was. There's no really term
okay.
for provost. You serve at the pleasure of the president.
Right.
So I went there under one president, John Strauss. He left, so I stayed on as the interim, not the interim, I was still provost, but the interim president, Jack Brown, who's deceased now. Mm. And he was more of a figurehead in the sense of keeping things, just keep the ship afloat till they recruit the next person.
Right.
And essentially told me, you run the place. Mm. And so after Strauss, the provostship was a bit more pleasurable in the sense that we had more authority.
Yeah.
And some of the issues that were with the previous administration were gone. Mm-hmm. It was a great period of building at WPI,
yeah.
but there were a lot of stigmas and issues with the leadership, tension between the university leader, the president and the trustees, and a huge recession.
Right.
This is after Dukakis's run for presidency. You know, going from Drexel, where I was building things all my life for 15 years, going to WPI, where we were cutting budgets by 8%, 7%, you know, 4 million this year, 5 million this year. It was a period of 4 years of just, you know, almost going bankrupt. So I actually asked myself, what the hell did I do at one point? But it was that's why I'm saying I'm thankful for the experience. It was a great learning experience.
Yeah.
So we had to come up with a plan. How do you save the place?
Right.
And I chaired a Blue Ribbon panel where it was a very important milestone in the university's history. It was about 75%, 80% engineering, mostly male. The place was, it's like going to a restaurant and all you have is meat and potatoes. You know?
Right.
So we're not attracting students who are technically savvy or technically centric, who may have interest in bio or life sciences or med, pre-med, or pre-law for patent attorneys.
Right.
So we're very narrow, monolithic in a way. So we expanded it. So the Blue Ribbon Commission that I chaired, after a year and a half, we said, we've got to make dramatic changes for us to survive. We got to go from 75, 80% engineering to 45, 50%. Life sciences have to increase. So it was a major turning point. And nothing happens real quick in university. So it took about 7, 8 years for that to happen.
Right.
And today, what you see is WPI, very prosperous, hot school, if I may call it that.
Prestigious, yes.
Yeah. Very prestigious. You know, inquiries are up like crazy. We're we send these beautiful letters to incredibly talented young men and women saying, you're not good enough to come to our place, essentially. We don't say it that way. but, you know, rejection rates are high.
Yeah.
And we're a private school, right? So we're not mandated to, like a UC system or someplace else, to take a certain number of. So, you know, we can do essentially what we want to do, but you got to pay for it yourself.
That's right.
So I got really interested in the administration of university, and I actually liked it. You know, it was just a difficult time.
Yeah, but a period of building. It was a crisis, but an opportunity to make
but you know, turnaround artists or whatever you want to call it. I never think of it myself that way, but that period between 1990 and 1997 at WPI, let history decide. But I think, you know, we made a major impact in changing the culture and changing the direction of the university for it to be prosperous in the future. But it was not easy to do.
And it sounds like you can have more opportunities for interdisciplinary collaboration when you get other forms of I mean, you could sort of choose the things that were kind of related to the engineering that was already there, and you could build on those strengths and include other things.
Exactly right.
But as you said, you didn't have as much time initially, at least, to do the research, to be involved in research communities, and to teach. So I am looking at papers you were publishing in the 90s, so there's things going on. But you are starting to write more about the nature of teaching, and so you're kind of more of a I don't know if public intellectual is the right word, but thinking about the nature of the project of education, and the nature of higher education in particular, with it, as it relates to engineering.
Well, you're right, Paul, because between 1990 and 97, I spent a lot of my time thinking about the academe, and how do you execute it? How do you provide a forum for young people to really learn? How do you enhance that learning? And how do you do it in a cost-effective way where, you know, tuitions, you know what they are, going up every year? How does a family who has four children can fund, you know, $250,000 per child.
Right.
How do they fund $1 million worth of tuition costs
right.
for four kids?
Right.
You know, it's just not. So actually, I wrote a paper which hasn't been published, but I send it to a bunch of people on globalization of education,
mm-hmm.
where I thought of having the faculty's role be not a lecturer in the classroom, but a facilitator of the learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Chemistry 101, which was the model.
Right.
You know, you have Chemistry 101 is taught at, I'm going to take a guess, at least 3,000 universities or colleges in America. Mm-hmm. We have 3,400 colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. So chemistry is probably taught at least at 2,500 places.
Right.
And you got a bunch of faculty in every one of these 2,500 places who are putting together a syllabus for Chemistry 101. So why don't we take the 100 best performances mm-hmm. in Chemistry 101, faculty who have incredible skills in oratory skills and getting the message across and YouTube videos and, you know,
mm-hmm.
the best of the best.
Right.
Take these 100, put them in a room someplace mm-hmm. for 5 weeks, pay them a lot of money and tell them, come up with 10 modules or 14 modules of Chemistry 101.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the content.
Yeah.
The knowledge,
right.
content. And then the distribution can be done the way we do it today.
Right.
Students can have access to that. The faculty's role is being that tutor back in 1450 in Oxford,
right,
where they're no longer lecturing on a blackboard and students are taking notes and taking an exam. Students can learn on their own. They're smart,
mm-hmm.
but have some great content
yeah.
that's put together by scholars.
Yeah.
And have the faculty's role be the facilitator of the learning environment. They can do their scholarship, of course, mm-hmm. but, you know, but that's very threatening.
Oh, yeah.
That's very threatening. And I've actually written about this. And the other thing that was not a very popular move on my part, or maybe insane or crazy, was the proposal I made that tenure should be reviewed every 5 or 6 years. So mm-hmm. once you get tenure after 6 years, the next 6 years thereafter, 12 years after you joined the university, you should be reviewed again.
Yeah.
Not be kicked out if you're not doing well,
right.
but real review,
yeah.
real critical review. And if you're not doing well, you know, get some feedback. What are the things you need to do?
Mm-hmm.
But this idea of having a contract for life,
right.
to me, is insane.
Right.
And I know it's not, you know, it's not a popular thing to say, and a lot of my colleagues will not like it, but I really down deep in my bones believe so.
Mm-hmm.
Accountability is a very important thing.
Yeah.
High standards have high standards and at the same time have accountability, and
mm-hmm.
that's how you make progress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and I think in the sciences and engineering, tenure just doesn't make any sense anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why in religion or philosophy or you know,
something more political.
Political,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
But we're living in a day and age where freedom of speech is protected.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But in the sciences, you know, is tenure really even relevant?
Mm-hmm. Especially, it also seems that, you know, and there's more circulation, it seems, or maybe I'm not right about that, but in engineers
yeah.
can move between the private industry and the academy, so there's
yeah.
not...
So I'm not being a critical of the academy. I mean, that's where I am. I love it. It's my place, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I feel comfortable there, and it's my home. But I'm always looking at how we can improve things.
The knowledge... a lot of people talk about a kind of service model for universities. Certainly at public university, officially, you are supposed to be of service to the state, to the people.
Right.
But that seems to be part of what makes you tick as well, that you want to be of use to multiple communities.
Exactly.
And that's part
exactly.
of it, you know.
I mean, if you look at higher education in general, what America has that is so it's unique is the community colleges.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back in the history in terms of how community colleges were formed, it's a beautiful history.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really leveraged that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could make a big impact. I think Obama administration is doing some good things on that.
Mm-hmm.
But
the plan to make, or the desire to make, community college free.
If Congress can become functional, maybe.
Right. So I would like to talk about, we have some time to talk about more work in the science.
Well, look, I'm only 69. Doing. Come back and talk to me 20 years from now.
Yeah, we have some long-lived engineers. There are some very long careers
to evaluate. I hope I that far.
In the early 90s, you were writing about the rise of intelligent processing, I think the paper title was "From Foundry Art to Intelligent Processing." So, can you talk a little bit about that transition and what's at play there?
Well, I forget that paper, but that's a good title. I came up with that, huh?
Yep, you did.
The motivation was really the droplet consolidation. Remember the three bins so far? And there are a couple more coming as time goes by. But in the droplet consolidation technology, spray casting, plasma deposition, it became quite evident that there were so many complexities that how to control the process was not going to be a simple simple thing. So I began to look at neural networks, fuzzy logic, how does a brain function, how do we know what to do, and how does that work? Because sometimes you don't really know why you're doing things, but you're doing it for the right reasons, you know. So how is machine learning come into being? So intelligent processing really was that. How can we take complex processes and make it controllable, you know, without necessarily understanding the mechanisms? And actually plasma deposition would be a good example to use to illustrate this. You have a technician who operates the plasma machine, the deposition. Plasma is nothing but an ionized gas, so it's a source of ionized gas, lots of enthalpy, lots of energy, lots of heat. You put in the powders through it. It begins to not necessarily completely melt, but become warmer. And you have all this momentum transfer, you know, because it's pushing out towards a substrate. So you have powders that are being deposited on a substrate. And a lot of variables. The powder size, the powder distribution, the temperature, the plasma speed, hundreds of variables. But a plasma operator who's been doing it for a while can tell you what knobs to change just by the sound, the decibel level of the plasma.
Oh my God.
They know whether things are not going right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So now we're trying to find out from them what is it that they understood so we can use that and put it into a controller. Yeah, we're engineers, we're going to do this thing. You start questioning the guy, and questioning is the wrong word to use, actually. You start asking questions.
Yeah,
they have no idea. They don't know why. But they know that if you do this, this happens. If you do this, this happens. You know, just like the American Indians knew years ago, without understanding anything about heat transfer or radiation, that if the sky at night is really clear and you can see all the stars, it's going to be cold night versus a sky that's clouded, without understanding any of the scientific mechanisms of it. Similarly, the plasma operator knows exactly what to do. How do you take that and put it into a machine learning approach? You know, how do you do it? So it's almost causal relationships. It's intelligent processing.
Right.
It's, you know, what works, what doesn't work, and creating a neural network, if you will, to control processes, just like the brain does.
So it's in that example, there's a detective work. So what changes when the sound changes, and trying to figure that out, and then figuring a way to sort of automate that with some kind of, as you said, a controller.
And also, quality assurance versus quality control fits under that. Mm-hmm. You know, quality control is when you're making something, you check on the quality, mm-hmm. and if it's not good, you reject it. That's what quality control is. Quality assurance is that at the end of the process, you don't have to do any quality control because at every step you've done it. You've assured it as it's going through the process. Mm-hmm. And you do that through intelligent processing, you do it through controls. Mm-hmm. But the key thing is to know what is important.
Right.
What is important for me to measure?
Right.
I know I'm being philosophical here, but you can't control anything unless you can measure it.
Right.
That's why they have these scales in the bathrooms, which I hate.
That's the frightening example.
Yeah. So if you can measure it, you can control it.
Yeah.
But then the question becomes, what do I measure?
Right.
And often, unfortunately, we measure the wrong things because there is a device that allows us to measure it, mm-hmm. irrespective of it.
Right.
Oh, I can measure this. Okay, I'll use it. Do I really need that?
Yeah. And we can make assumptions that because we're measuring one parameter, that we have it in the bag, that there's nothing else going on.
Yeah.
I think that that can be a real problem.
Yeah.
So we talked about the sort of five buckets areas. We're coming into a period now, mid-90s. A couple of things, I guess, the Materials Processing Institute. Can you talk a little bit about that? And
of course, yeah. It's an important one, in fact. And I need to segue to Drexel years, WPI, and mm-hmm. the Metals Processing Institute. The Metals Processing Institute, let me just tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's an institute that, as the name implies, deals with metals mm-hmm. and deals with processes that relate to metals, mm-hmm. okay? Metal. So, and in fact, 95% of the time, it's on metals processing. Maybe 5% of the time, it's on mental processing. but it has a very clear mission,
mm-hmm.
And we don't confuse ourselves that we do all things to all people. It's very metals related.
Okay, it's not polymers or anything.
We don't do polymers. Okay. Of course, you can't exclude polymers, right. But our main interest is not polymers or ceramics.
Right.
It's metals. Okay. And within that, we have three centers. This is today now.
Right.
But I need to go back and explain how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
We have three centers. One is the Advanced Casting Research Center, which is a center dedicated to the casting industry. The members of the casting center are about 34 companies
mm-hmm.
who've been with us for 30 years almost. And they represent casters. They represent people who use the castings, like the automotive industry.
Yep.
And they represent companies that make the metal that you use to make the castings. So it's a confluence of various segments of the industry, and we're the educational home for that industry.
Mm.
Companies pay a certain fee on a yearly basis, about $20,000 to $30,000 a year. Those monies go into the kitty, and they allow us to have projects that serve the needs of the members. So it's fundamental research with a utility or an application in mind. So the same model applies for the casting center, to the heat treating center, thermal processes, including plasma, cold spray. And the last center, the third center, is the recycling and recovery center.
Mm.
So it's a big institute that I started, and I'm the head of it now. And close to 90 corporations are involved in the center.
Mm.
That's big.
Yeah.
The way this started was way back at Drexel, I had a casting center, which was made up of about 12 or 15 companies, not 34. And when I was leaving Drexel to come to WPI, the chairman of the board of the 12 companies, they went to the dean. They said, well, Appelian is leaving to go to WPI. What are we going to do? Are you going to hire somebody else to be in this area of metal casting and silification processing, metal processing, because, you know, we like it here. You know, we want to stay here. Unfortunately, the dean didn't say the right thing. He said, well, you know, we probably are not going to replace him with another person of this kind because the interest was in probably somewhere else, nano, bio, whatever. I was not in the room, but I can only surmise what took place. So the chairman came to me and said afterwards, I remember, you know, most of us don't live in Pennsylvania. We come here. Instead of flying to Philly, we can fly to Boston. So we're going to come with you. Take us with you. So that was a lucky thing, because if I didn't have that casting center with me at WPI, I probably would have completely been sucked into, if you will, into the administrative side of the house. Yeah. And for 7 years later, I probably would have had a very difficult transition to make to go back to the faculty. Mm-hmm. So the casting center went with me from Drexel. Mm. The plasma center didn't. I left that behind with Ron Smith. Mm-hmm. But the casting center went with me. I had a postdoc, Shiv Kumar, who came along, and he became an assistant professor at WPI. So, you know, between 1990 and 97, while I was provost, the casting center was there, and on Saturdays, Sundays, at nights, I would be involved. Mm-hmm. So I had, thankfully, that tie with the research world.
Yeah, I was wondering how you were able to do that.
That's the only reason, I think. It would have been incredibly difficult for me after a 7-year hiatus to go back. So even though it was a lot more work, I was trying to keep up with it, and at times was becoming almost non-manageable.
Yeah.
But with my family's support, they didn't see much of me between 90 and 97.
Yeah.
I was able to come back to it. So in 97, when I left the provostship, I didn't finish the story. So I had one presidency, then I had an interim president, I had Ed Parrish, who came in as president. Wonderful man, but our styles were very different. It was quite apparent that he and I were not going to be able to work together. So we agreed that I was going to leave.
Yeah.
And with his support and blessing, and it's been very supportive over the years. So I actually served under three presidents at WPI in a period of 7 years, you know. One president, John Strass, for 4 or 5 years, Jack Brown, and then Ed Parrish. Mm-hmm. And actually, I was going to Bucknell for a presidency. Mm. I thought that would be the next tier for me.
Right.
And I recall one night in Santorini on a vacation, first vacation I've had in a long time, my wife asked, why do you want to do this? Because, you know, we're urban, we love opera, and Bucknell, it's a wonderful place, but it's not, you know, mainstream America. Mm-hmm. It's near Pittsburgh, Harrisburg.
Yeah.
And in a complete, you know, when you're on vacation, you've had a couple of glasses of wine, you're much more natural, and you're
and clear, in
clear,
a sense.
And you know, the beach, and we're sitting on it. I said, I think it's because it's probably ego. I want to show my colleagues I can do this. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, that's a hell of a good reason to do it, right? That's the next day I decided what I was going to do. It was a transformative moment for me.
That's wonderful. It's also family. The family they know you. And sometimes they can really help you make choices.
Well, they anchor you. I mean, my Seta, my wife, you haven't met, she's my anchor. She's very noble and can see things through. And that was a transformative moment. I said, yeah, this is silly.
Yeah.
Why do I want to the academy? What do I love to do? I love working with students. I love to teach. I love to do research.
Right.
So, you know, I've done my thing.
Right. You did your service.
Should I really go for presidencies anymore? Even though I'm good with people. I love people. Mm-hmm. I'd like to raise money.
Yeah.
I'd like to build things. I said, you know, I'm going to go back to my first love, mm-hmm. and that was a major decision.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
And I remember it's almost like a transformation where, you know, all of a sudden you become really happy, you know. Mm-hmm. You relieve some burdens.
Yes.
Yeah, because the provostship was in a tough era, you know, when you're cutting budgets all the time and rebuilding things, reconfiguring things. It's tense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tense.
Yeah. So you were able to,
I was able to jump right back in.
And so that the Metals Processing Institute is is fully established at its.
Well, it was in 97 when I came back to the faculty.
Yeah.
Remember, I was going to leave.
Yeah.
And then decided to stay after that conversation with my wife, and also the chairman of the board, Howard Freeman, came over one night and says, "What the hell are you doing? We heard you maybe leave. We want you to stay here." So I stayed at WPI, and thank God I did. I love the place and my colleagues there. The casting center was there. We hired Professor Makhlouf, who became a partner with me in building the casting center. And then we established a heat treating center about a few years later. And in five, six years ago, we established the recycling center. So it didn't happen overnight, but between 1997 and today, 2015, over a period of time, we have now three centers. As I said, it's the largest industry university collaborative in America. Over 90 corporations.
Largest by number of corporations, or largest by total investment?
By number of companies. Investments, I don't know, I haven't really done a calculation, but on a yearly basis, we're bringing about $3 million a year just from the fees of the companies, but then we supplement that with federal government support. Our portfolio comes from three places. One is the fees that each company puts in to have the pre-competitive research projects that we have, very much fueled by their needs, but fundamental, not job shop. Then we go after large governmental contracts, leveraging the relationships we have with corporations, because the government likes to see dissemination and transfer of technology. I mean, this year we have the last couple of years we've had a $14 million contract with the Army Research Lab in magnesium alloys and rare earth elements. Rick Sisson and I and others on cold spray technology with the Army Research Lab, about $8 million. A Department of Energy mini mills for aluminum, $3 million with Erica Corporation. So we supplement our base, the $3 million, with lots of funding from the federal government. And then we do get involved in proprietary, more not pre-competitive, but where the IP is either owned by the university or jointly owned by industry or wholly owned by the industry, depending on who's bringing the IP to the table. Projects with industry that are not published yet, unless you know, they're more proprietary. So three ways that we do it. So the institute is a very vibrant and a very important institute that I've spent the last 10, 15 years of my life building it.
Did you? It sounds like it just evolved over time, and I was going to ask you if you looked at models at other universities or for industry university collaboration, or if you did got some advice from different domains. But it sounds like it evolved for over a very long period of time.
Yeah, it's at the expense of sounding presumptuous, which hopefully by now you've assessed that I'm not a presumptuous ass, but you know. At the expense of sounding presumptuous, I think we were pioneers. When I say we, the companies that were involved with me were pioneers with me to build a model that I think will be here for a long time. In fact, we were the casting center at Drexel was even before the NSF IUCRCs, which is the Industry University Cooperative Research Centers. That was before that time. And again, I think much of it is influenced by the theory and practice, co-op at Drexel, bringing, the T.S. Eliot model, bringing things together. And making some sense out of it.
And do you think it's, when you say pre-competitive, is this important distinction, right? That this is it's requests from industry, or rather investment from industry, that trusts that you are going to work on fundamental questions.
That's right.
That will benefit all of those industries.
I mean, you've said it beautifully, but that's not the way most industries would articulate. I mean, you know about Henry Cheeseborough, the open innovation book, innovation concept at Berkeley. Well, that model, essentially what we've done 20, 30 years ago, but most industry doesn't think that way.
Right.
In fact, most industries think, in general, I hate to generalize, but in general, that they have a certain IP.
Yeah.
That this is their baby. This is their crown jewel, if you will. And hell, they're not going to share that with anybody. They're going to protect that, as they should.
Mm-hmm.
But then they take that to such an extent that it becomes diffuse as to what is the crown jewels
right.
that must be kept secret, and what are the things that they can collaborate and learn from each other.
Right.
So when we first formed the casting center, I recall, because it was a small number, 10 to 12 people, and when you're putting together a group like that, of course you have had conversations with each one of them, as I had. And each one of them had shared with me an issue that they have.
Yeah.
You know, a problem in their factories, in their field. And at the first meeting we had, nobody was saying anything. Everybody was silent. So knowing the personalities and, you know, to the extent that I could pull it off, I said, hey, guys, you all have a secret. You've shared that with me and privately. But I got to tell you, you all have the same secret. And thankfully, one of the people said, what is that secret? Thankfully. Otherwise, it would not have worked.
Right.
And I said, you don't know what the hell you're doing. You all have the same problem. And that sort of broke the ice, that they realized that, you know, the realization that winners don't compete.
Yeah.
True winners don't compete.
Yeah.
True winners collaborate so that to bring everything, you know, the tide comes up and all the sailboats rise. Mm-hmm. And everybody benefits. So that's what we do. We try to identify issues that are critically pivotal, important to the industry, you know, mechanistic, that if we really understand these things, we're going to be able to do all kinds of things. And Mercury Marine will do it for outboard engines. Audi will do it for cars. Harley-Davidson, a member, will do it for motorcycles.
Right.
You know, everybody benefits.
Right.
You know, having data on crack initiation, crack propagation, and fatigue, and aluminum is a basic knowledge that everybody needs. Mm-hmm. They can use it any way they want to.
Mm-hmm.
But that realization, I think, is one of our contributions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That open innovation, by collaborating, we can all win.
Yeah.
And we can all advance.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me that the industry has gotten... they've kind of figured out what can happen as a result of this collaboration. Has there also been a learning curve for the NSF and the other federal agencies?
I really can't speak for them. I think we've been a good model for others to emulate. I know so because others are actually wanting copies of our bylaws and how do we do it. We've had colleagues from other universities come mm-hmm. to visit us and be guests at our meetings. We're very open about that. Mm-hmm. And they have to sign an NDA because some of the stuff that we discuss, you know, we don't want them to get out. But, you know, we're open about it. Let people come and see it.
Right.
And I've actually talked and presented at various forums as to how this model works, because we truly believe this is not something unique to us. It's a really good way of doing mm-hmm. research and development. But the beneficiary is not really, the beneficiary, of course, is the industry.
Yeah.
Of course, the professors involved. But the true beneficiaries are the students.
Yeah.
Imagine, when I was doing my PhD, I know it was funded by DARPA. I didn't know exactly what the applications were. I didn't know who was going to read the papers I was writing. I didn't interface during my PhD with the end user mm-hmm. of what I was working on.
Yeah.
All the students, that the projects that I supervise or my colleagues at the Metals Processing Institute supervise with their students, every one of the students meets twice a year with the industrial members, twice a year, if not more, because every 2 months there's a telecon with a group of industry members who are interested in that project. Feedback, input, why are you doing this? Why are you not doing this? Have you looked at this? You're doing the wrong thing. Come to the plant. Come to see us. Spend some time with us. That integration of relearning, the students that come out are, you know, they're ready. They're ready to run.
And have contacts.
Have
now.
Contacts and confidence. Mm-hmm. And confidence and a holistic understanding of what they're working on and how it fits. They have no idea because they don't know what it's like not to do it that way, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But it's just a fantastic model, mm-hmm. and we're very proud of.
Can I ask you about how some of that research has become important for resource recovery and recycling?
Well, I mean, the resource recovery recycling is a fairly recent center, right?
Yeah.
So it's about 5 years old. In fact, this June, we will be celebrating June 2 and 3. Not 2015, celebrating 30 years of the Casting Research Center, mm-hmm. 30 continuously run years with the industrial base,
yeah.
15 years of the Heat Treating Center, CHD, and 5 years of the Recycling Center, CR3. So 50 years. I sound old when I say that, but 50 years of, you know, 50 times, yeah, a lot of meetings.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So the you know, we talked about molten metal processing and casting.
Yep.
We talked about droplet consolidation, intelligent processing. But the last few years, I would say, those all have continued, mm-hmm. especially with the casting center and the heat treating center within the institute, the Metals Processing Institute. But more recent activities would be in the Center for Resource Recovery Recycling, mm-hmm. which is a baby of ours now, and we have a lot of passion for it. Mm-hmm. And also, more recently, the additive manufacturing activities that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
The Recycling Center, let me call it Recycling Center, though, the emphasis really is not recycling, it's mm-hmm. resource recovery mm-hmm. and reuse.
Mm-hmm.
And people call that recycling, but it's a lot more than just recycling.
Mm-hmm.
They came into being when I was asked by TMS and ASM to give the distinguished lecture on materials and society. Mm-hmm. So this is a lecture. Remember I told you earlier before we did the interview that I have an interest in history of science and technology mm-hmm. as well. So I took that opportunity to really delve into it. From that perspective of history of science and technology. Where have we been? Where are we going? What is the world going to look like in 20, 30, 40, you know, 9 billion people versus 1.6 billion at the beginning of the century?
Mm-hmm.
The consumption of materials and the consumption of goods and products and how they're not being reused. So that was a revelation. I gave that lecture in 2000, I think, 7 or 8 or 9, something like
that's
that.
Right.
Sorry, I can't remember the time. And then from there on, it became quite apparent that we need to do something. So we started a center. And that's an NSF center, actually. It's an NSF IUCRC.
Mm-hmm.
The IUCRC's Industry University Cooperative Research Center, you have to have 3 universities, or more than one.
Yeah.
So Brijender Mishra at Colorado School of Mines is my associate director, colleague, partner. And Bart Blampin at Catholic University, KU actually, they've changed their name, KU Leuven in Belgium.
Mm.
3 universities coming together. And we formed a center 5 years ago.
Mm.
What we do is look at sustainability as a driving force. And what we did is looked at what is the most sustainable organism that we have, that we know of. And it's nature. Nature's been around a long time. And nature has certain attributes and characteristics that are dramatically different from the industrial world in which we live in. Nature doesn't have waste. You know, the cherry tree, everything gets recycled, you know. Nature is a closed-loop system. Mm-hmm. In nature, there are a lot of subsystems. If you look at watersheds and all that, a lot of subsystems feeding each other, holistic. And nature doesn't use that many elements. There are very few elements in nature. Mm-hmm. And the state of well-being in nature is equilibrium. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm a capitalist, believe mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. But we can learn from nature, because in the industrial system, it's open loop, lots of waste, and the state of well-being is growth.
Right.
You know. Can you imagine reading an annual report from a major corporation saying,
equilibrium.
We're equilibrium. Yeah. We haven't grown a damn.
We're exactly where we were last year.
We've been the same the last 10 years. We're sustainable. Yeah, sure. That's what shareholders really love. But we can learn a lot from nature. We can learn a lot from nature. Mm-hmm. So production waste, all the things that we make. Aluminum, every ton of aluminum is made, we have 3 tons of red mud. You know, what do you do with all this stuff? Production waste. Consumer waste. My iPhone is a good example of it. Mm-hmm. What happens to it at? But the iPhone has 59 different elements in it. Mm-hmm. We never had that kind of a product before. Mm-hmm. You know, in the last 20 years, if you look at transformations, our products have become much more functional.
Yeah.
We made things before because it was strong, high integrity, structural.
Yeah.
Structural integrity, bridges, cars, you know, lasted a long time.
Yeah.
Today, the products we have a lot of functionalities. You know, the iPad, the iPhone, your electronics, your television, which is a computer in a way. Mm-hmm. Laptops, computers, you know, we didn't have those 30 years ago. Laser pointers, you name it.
Right.
Well, these functionalities come about because of the electronic nature of the elements, mm-hmm. you know, the rare earth elements, you know.
Right.
They have very special characteristics, magnetic properties, and many others. Phosphorus, luminescence, you know, LEDs. Yeah. So we're using a lot more of these. So a lot of waste from production, mm-hmm. post-consumer waste, which is not being reused, recovered and reused as well. And then we have needs for sensors and controls to be able to do these things. So, and also the concept of manufacturing things meaning components, mm-hmm. that society needs and has a need for and wants, that can be, at the end of life, be disassembled easily.
Right.
We don't make we don't make that many things today. I was going to say nothing. We do make some. We don't make that many things that can be disassembled easily after life.
No.
Again, the iPhone. I hate to pick on Apple because I love Apple, but.
No, but to treat that it's you know, you'd have to have really advanced metallurgy to take apart an iPhone to separate out all of those processes.
Well, to actually recover and reuse, you got to take the battery out.
Yeah.
That's the first thing you got to do. Because it's, you know, it can explode.
Yeah.
It's a fire hazard. So you got to take the battery out before you can shred it and cut it and recover and reuse. Mm-hmm. Well, try to take the battery out of your iPhone. Yeah. It's a closed system.
Right.
Purposefully.
Right.
I mean, you can buy a special screwdriver on eBay.
Yeah.
But should it be that way?
Right. Right.
Should we have things made in such a way that it can be easily repaired, mm-hmm. and not the need to repurchase a new one?
Right.
Could the things that we have are modular, mm-hmm. where you don't have to rebuy a new one because it's good for the economy, mm-hmm. but rather you just buy module and, yeah.
So is that institute doing that kind of research? In terms of how you can...
Actually, our institute is doing 3 things.
Okay.
And some of them are more prominent than others, but we're actually have our foundations on 3 things. That, again, this is just philosophically, maybe vision, whatever. Mm. One is education. The other one, the 3 legs of the stool. Mm. Education. The other one is policy. The third one is technology innovation. So most centers work on the technology side. But in this space of recovery of resources and recycling, it is you need all three of those. And I'm not going to be abstract. I'm going to be specific. Educating people, this is very fundamental, that taking a battery, you know, when it's used and you need to change a battery in your laptop or your mouse or your keyboard, you take the old battery and you throw it in the garbage can.
Yeah.
I've seen people do it.
Yeah.
That's a bad thing. You know, where does it go?
Yeah.
You know, batteries have a lot of chemicals in them. If they end up in a landfill and rains, all that chemical toxicity, landfills always leak.
Yeah.
It's going to end up in the earth.
Yeah.
It's going to come back and bite you. Nail polish.
Right.
Paint removers. You don't put those things in the trash. Education.
Right.
Second one is policy, where the government puts a rule, there's a law, as to how to abide by it. Because one company is not going to do anything unless there is a level playing field. So policy is really important. And the technology, of course, is the innovations and the technology that you need to be able to recover the materials and lithium-ion batteries. How do you recover the cathode materials? How do you reuse it? You know, things of that sort. A lot of science and a lot of extractive metallurgy that goes into it. So we're based on three, anchored in three ways in our in our mindset.
Well, since we're here at TMS, at this conference, and there's an awful lot of young people out here attending talks and giving talks, can you talk a little bit about the changing role of TMS in over the years, and where you think it, the society and all the members of the society need to be thinking about in the future?
Wow, that's a tall order.
That is a tall order.
Yeah.
Sorry to spring it on you.
How does society is changing, how it has changed, that's one thing.
Yeah.
And wow. Well, TMS is a global organization. You know, 42% of the members are non-US. So it's a global organization, and it's a professional community where people come together to share with each other. There's an efficacy almost like in the web, where people want to share with each other what they're working on.
Yeah.
Nothing mandates them, but there's that incredibly wonderful efficacy in scientists and professionals and engineers where they want to share with each other what they're doing and learn from each other. So that will, I think, always will be there, and that's one of the most wonderful things about TMS. It's a community of learners coming together and learning from each other.
Yeah.
At the same time, making advances and having a voice. You know, we have a voice in on the Hill. We have a voice in through our publications. And it's a place where professionals and pre-professionals, graduate students, before they become, you know, in their career, have a home where they can learn from each other and be mentored by others who are in the profession. So I think that has not changed. It just has gotten better.
Yeah.
Has gotten a lot better. A recognition of our membership is 42% non-US. In fact, we had a conversation last night that maybe every 5 years this meeting should be overseas. Why not? Florida is very foreign to me right now from Boston. I don't see any snow. I think TMS hasn't changed in terms of its mission. It just has gotten better and better and more global.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a whole initiative with Latin America, South America, North America and South America, our Canadian partners in the north, our Mexican and Latin American partners in the south, as well as Europe. That's global. In terms of the changes, we're living in an age where the young, we're talking about the young generation now, not people who are my age or mid-career. The very young generation feels, again, generalizing, that they don't need to belong to anything because everything's available to them.
Right.
You know, I can be, I can blog, I can tweet, I can, you know, all this stuff. So that's where the challenge for TMS is, and I think that's where we're making a difference in a successful way, that the things that TMS offers, the community that you see here, you can't blog this, you can't tweet this, you can't do Facebook. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different personal
face-to-face.
Yeah. And it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. You didn't ask me, but I mean, the reason the Metals Processing Institute is what it is today and why we have 90 corporate members, it's all because of relationships.
Yeah.
They're not doing it because of my looks or, you know, it's all about relationships.
Yeah.
Doing what you say you're going to do. Mm-hmm. Being genuine and sincere about your motives and your mission. Mm-hmm. And delivering on the promise.
Right. Trust.
Trust.
Yeah.
Relationships that are long-term. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're not looking for new relationships every day.
Right.
I'm not looking for a new customer every day.
Right.
So if you do things the right way, let's use the word customer. You'll have a customer for life. Mm-hmm. You don't have to look for a new customer every day. You know, you have a long-term relationship. It's based on trust. You know, do what you say you're going to do. Deliver on the promise, mm-hmm. and be genuine and give feedback.
Yeah,
but also hold people accountable.
Right.
And excel. So those have been probably. I don't think I had these like a compass when I was a younger person, but I think in reflection, those were the compasses that I had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for taking the time to sit with us and talk.
Sure, it's been fun.